I would like to use some of the insights that came about last night in Dallas's address as talking points for us as we think through the leadership issue. And this is the format that I would like to use for this first part, and then we'll see how to continue it after Dallas comes in at us with some of his thoughts related to the issue of discipleship and its attendant concerns. I would like to make a couple of opening statements, few opening statements, and then to bring into this circle of chairs here a few people that I have bumped into along the way yesterday. And any number of you could have been in these chairs, could be in these chairs. In fact, the people who will be here are not representative even yet of the kind of diversity we need in these conversations, but they are people that that came into my space during the interim periods yesterday, and I've invited some of those people to join me in a conversation up here as this time moves along. And as we talk together in whatever ways, whatever shape that takes, then I will keep trying to go back and forth between that conversation and asking you to raise thoughts or to focus thoughts or to think quietly, if you will, about the implications of what is being said for the new definitions of leadership that we need to craft around the concerns that are part of this conference. Also, let me say that first, Peter, thank you for the work you've done in bringing this together and organizing it. May I suggest that a conference is one mode in which we need to deal with these issues, but also what we need are a series of consultations where numbers of you can gather together and continue the thinking and the writing and in your own places of ministry that you form communities of discourse, trying to bring some of your thoughts and your responses to what's happened here these 2 days into the spaces where you work and where you minister. And little by little to create dialogue partners with the people you are with. And a conference like this can just absolutely fall flat and can die unless you take away from it what you believe is important and what the Spirit of God is moving in your heart to suggest is important, and you take it and you move with it and you write it and you think it and you talk it. And the responsibility that Dallas focused last night about being partners together in this enterprise of leadership, each joint. That is also very true of a situation such as this. This will not work unless we all go from here, all of us, to try and make it work. So I throw this responsibility on you, not to let it drop here or not to leave it here when you get on a plane or get in your car or whatever you get into in order to get home. Okay. As we were participating together in the moments of worship that we had, Moses' life came to mind as an example of someone who struggled through issues of leadership, both at a cognitive level, rational level, if you please, at a spiritual level, and at a deeply personal level. When sermons or books are written about Moses as leader, and the example from his life that is selected as the model of leadership to look to, his experience with Jethro is often the experience that's cited. And I would suggest to you that that is probably the weakest example in his life of what leadership needs to be. And again, I can feel the hammers of the guns going back, but anyway. The temporariness, I think, of that model to fit a particular circumstance is instructive, at least to me. I think the real lessons from Moses' life are found closer to the end of his life, as the end of his life reflects the experiences not only at the beginning, but all the way through. And without launching into a long discourse about this, let me just throw out some of my own thoughts as I think about this man, his walk with the Lord, and what he may have to teach us all about what leadership is. I am intrigued by an experience that occurred pretty much at the end of his life. Two experiences, actually. Three experiences. One, Exodus 33, where the maturing Moses had come to the point where he asked God to show him his glory. And God's statement that you can't look on me and live. And I'm doing some huge paraphrasing here. And what strikes me about that event, I think, that's important, is when you compare that event with what happened in Exodus 3, when there's virtually the same thing going on, where God is showing Moses his glory. Now, if Moses was being asked by God in Exodus 3, the burning bush, to undertake a very substantial leadership responsibility to go back to Egypt and, if you please, create a people, why was not the same kind of manifestation of God present in Acts chapter 3 as it was, Exodus 3 as it was in 33? And when you lay those two chapters on top of one another and look at them side by side or through each other, you put them on a transparency, if you like, and look through them to each other, I think that the thinking that stimulates tells us very much about what leadership is and how leadership is formed. And Moses was not ready for the kind of experience he had with God in 33. But in Exodus 33, his statements about the forming of a people were extraordinarily profound, much more profound than he ever could have imagined in Exodus 3 when he was being asked to go and form a people. In Exodus 33, Moses says, "We are not even a people unless you are with us." In Exodus 3, "Hey, God, it's all about me. I can't speak. I can't go. I can't do this." In Exodus 33, it's all about God. So what's happened in the intervening chapters that have produced a person who is, in fact, able to be the kind of leaderless leader that his people demanded? And I would suggest to you again that I do not believe that the Jethro experience is the best model we have of what he learned. The second experience is the trauma, the terrible, terrible pain that he experienced when he disobeyed God and struck the rock and instead of speaking to it toward the end of his life. And because of that, neither he nor Aaron were allowed by God to enter the promised land. And this was one of the most bitter, bitter experiences of Moses' life. And he pled with God, and he argued with God, and he pleaded with God, "Please let me go." And God finally just put his foot down, so to speak, and said, "No, you failed to honor me as holy in the sight of this people." And Moses was content. There's a lesson there also about leadership, if you allow it to sit in your mind for a while. And I would suggest to you to take that experience and couple it with the last and third experience that I want to draw our attention to today. And that is toward the end, I think Deuteronomy 31, I was looking it up, I think it's 31, when God said to Moses and to Joshua, "Come into the tabernacle, I want to talk with you one last time." And Moses and Joshua go into the tabernacle, and Joshua was kind of sitting in a corner listening to all of this. And God says to Moses, in effect, and again, I'm paraphrasing wildly here, Moses, I want you to know this at the end of your life. You're ready to lay down your leadership, lay down your life. And I just want you to know this, Moses, before you go off to Mount Nebo and walk off to wherever you walk to. I want you to know that after all these years of investment and pain and toil and struggle and sacrifice with this people called by my name, Moses, I want you to know this about your life and leadership before you die. This people, after you die, they will prostitute themselves, they will seek after other gods, they will abandon me, they will walk away from me, they will forsake me. And Moses, even more terrible, I want you to know this, I will turn my back on them. Just want you to know that before you die. He goes up to Mount Nebo and he sits on that ledge, and God says, Moses, you can't go there, but I want to point out to you where your people are going to be living. There's Dan, he's going to camp there. Judah's tribe is going to be there, and so on. You can't go there, Moses, but I just want you to know where they'll be. How would you feel if you had spent the years of investment in leadership that Moses had spent, and you have this experience as your final memory, and the word of God in the tabernacle as your final memory? Let me suggest to you that our contemporary notions of success and failure in leadership are blown all to pieces by the story of Moses. If you look at the end of Moses' life and you try to make some success statements out of that, it's very hard to do. If you look at the lessons that Moses learned, that is extremely instructive. If you look at the pattern of Moses' life, that is even more instructive. Because the pattern of Moses' life is tied up in the formation of a people, yes. But you remember Dallas's words right at the very beginning last night? There is no right church. The church is not right, or something to that effect. And the profound lesson that Moses had to learn, and the profound lesson that we all have to learn, is that success is not bound up in the creation of institutions. Success is bound up in growing to comprehend with spiritual insight and maturity what God's purpose is for the people that he gathers for his name. And you have to think, and I would encourage you to do this, think about two things as you try to make sense of Moses' life and leadership in relation to your own life and leadership. Think about his epitaph. After all that happened in those final moments of Moses' life, the epitaph is an astonishing contrast. And as you look at the epitaph, 34, 35 of Deuteronomy, there has been no prophet such as Moses. And read the epitaph for yourself and notice what it is that Moses is commended for. What is it that forms in that short package of words the fulfillment of Moses' leadership? What is he remembered for? And then go over to Hebrews chapter 11, and in that great litany of the heroes of the faith, look down the list to Moses, and again, look at what he's remembered for. By faith, Moses, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter and chose. And read the rest of that. Put all of those pieces together. The experiences across his lifetime, Exodus 3, Exodus 33, the bitter pain of the rock, the must have been absolutely terrible words in the tabernacle, the pain of seeing where this people he had led and expected to lead into the wilderness to see where they were going to live, but he couldn't go there, and the epitaph and the Hebrews passage. Put all of that together and see what it says to you about your own practices of leadership and your own perceptions of leadership. That kind of example stands in marked contrast to this advertisement for a new pastor. I've forgotten the documentation on this, but this is an actual ad for a pastor. 275-year-old church, over 1,000 professional, talented, faithful members, 3 worship services, rich music programs, active facility, including counseling center, nursery school, renowned library, substantial endowment, the C, proud history, attractive building on traditional New England town green, diverse and tolerant community of 600,000 with strong school system, recent ongoing refocusing of mission and structure involving external consultants. Anybody want to know where this? You want to know where this is? When I put something like this up against reflections on matters such as Dallas brought to us yesterday and will continue to bring to us today, and reflections on not just the life of Moses but other leaders that are represented in the scriptures, I get very sad when I read something like this. But it's telling us something, perhaps, about our times and about the church in our times. And it's also telling us that we just can't not fight this battle. To prepare for the conversation that we will have in a few moments and that you will listen to and the best as we can to respond to, I would like to focus 2 or 3 things that I heard last night and ask you to think about them. And those of you who will be kind of the conversation partners here, you will bring your own ideas into this conversation. Please do that. But you may also want to respond to some of these thoughts that I am focusing from last night. Dallas described an institution, and I may be getting some of these words out of order here or not capturing it rightly, and if I am, please correct me. But the definition of an institution was interesting. A definition to the effect that an institution is patterns of recognizable actions and reactions that survive across generations. Is that right? Okay, the instructive word there, at least for me, is patterns. And as I listened to that, I thought, how quickly, when Dallas uses the word institution, how quickly my mind goes from the word institution, crosses over the definition to a building or a structure. And that's not what he said. The definition of institution is not a building that holds people. The definition of an institution is patterns of action and reaction. So as we think about that, it's forcing us in our North American climate, perhaps more so than anywhere else, to rethink what institutions really are. And when we think about the emphasis of last night, that it is not clever marketing or a human leader that gathers people. It is God who gathers His church for His purposes. We could very well ask the question, where are His people gathered? Are they just simply gathered in church structures? And are the patterns in those church structures the kinds of patterns that are appropriate? If we can somehow separate ourselves from our common understandings of institutional forms and begin to think about the more important issue, that it is God who chooses and gathers, then we can ask with some freedom, where are we gathered? Where should we be gathered? And what are the kinds of patterns of action and reaction that are important when we gather, wherever we gather, however we gather? One of the patterns that is glaringly apparent in the Old Testament, and then as it carries over into the New, is that the culture, if you please, the institution broadly defined, the patterns of action, reaction of the people of God in Scripture, seem to me to rest on three legs. One of those legs is the worship of God. The other leg is the obedience to His law or His word. And the other leg is justice to the neighbor. And I would, as I think about that, it makes me much more intentional to seek holism in this organism that we call church, and to say, if I take away one of those legs, the whole pattern is weakened. And somehow we have got to keep in appropriate tension and appropriate relationship those functions of worship of God, obedience to His law or His word, and justice to the neighbor. Another thought from last night, oh, by the way, sometime look up some of Parker Palmer's writings and others, where he, among others, is becoming more vocal about the need to be in the need for the church to be the church in the public square. And that's been one of the hallmarks of the Regent community, is to be in the public square. And I think that deserves some attention. And also the question again, what then is the role of the leader in all of this? Another point that Dallas made last night had to do with voluntarism, the voluntary choices that people feel they can make. I can choose to be part of this community. I can choose not to be. I can choose to walk away when it suits me. I can choose to come back when it suits me. Now, that's very human, but I heard Dallas speaking from a biblical reference point that is not really a godly response. And as I sat there thinking about that, I thought that the voluntary syndrome inevitably leads, as he highlighted, to the consequence of promotion, marketing, and all of those kinds of things that we feel we have to do to drag people to our place where we are trying to gather people. And the sense that that is not the appropriate way to envision the role of leadership in this community just was in great neon flashing lights to me last night. If it is not appropriate, then again, what is the role of leadership? What are new definitions of leadership for the people of God, among the people of God, every joint? What are the implications of that for our time? Third point, if we want to see the result of Christ, Dallas said, we have to preach the message of Christ. And then just kind of skipped into, for our thinking, that the message of Christ is not always crystal clear. And in some respects, yes, it is crystal clear. I mean, it's in our faces all the time. In other respects, there is a lot of room, as we know, for an interpretation, working it out, contextualizing, seeking ways to make relevant, and all of those kinds of matters. And as he said that, I thought about the contemporary need, ever more urgent, of a hermeneutical community, if I can use that term. Are we now in the 21st century, in this century so influenced by postmodernism and other isms, are we in even greater need for the formation of hermeneutical communities who are engaged in dialogue and discourse together based upon the kinds of values and character intentions that are biblically grounded and guided, facilitated by leaders who are, in fact, apt to teach and not a novice? What becomes the definition of leadership if we desperately need, as I think we do, hermeneutical or interpretive communities that keep truth before us, but allow for the Spirit of God to speak among and through and in his people? It is so hard sometimes for members of congregations to speak to one another because they don't like each other. And they are so afraid of each other. And I've been there. And I know what it's like to go into a business meeting with a proposal that you have in hand, and the key thought in your heart and your mind is, I know there's going to be the verbal, vocal minority over there that's going to trash this whole thing. I know that there's going to be a fight on the floor of this business meeting. I know that there's going to be backroom conversations after the meeting's over. I know that I'm going to get cards and letters in the mail when I get back to my office next week. But I also know that there are seeds of productive discourse and spirituality that are present also in that gathering. And we live always with this tension of what is and what is yet to be as we are part of congregational communities. And the fight to stimulate maturing is just ever important. Another thought in relation to that, and then I would like to bring our friends forward for a bit. This issue of relevance and contextualization becomes important, and a couple of our friends have some concerns on that matter that they brought to me with some passion yesterday, and I asked, therefore, that they focus it in their own words, not in my words. So that will come into our conversation. But I remember one of my theology professors years ago, who, in speaking of children, interestingly enough, said, we've got this thing all backwards. We begin with teaching, we stick kids in classes and we tell them things, then we stick them in worship services so they can learn to sit still, so they will become productive worship attenders as they grow up, and then we really hope, that they will live the life of the Christian faith. He says, we've got it all wrong. We've got it all back to front. What we need to do with children, he is saying, and I would maintain that it has larger implications than that, what we need to do is begin with what he called the ethic of the community. We need to see children, particularly, as part of the ethic and the life of the community of faith, where they are learning almost non-formally, informally, by osmosis, without conscious thought sometimes. They are seeing, they are learning, they are thinking, they are feeling the ethic of this community, which of course has profound implications on the way that community is fashioned and the way that community works together, because little eyes and little ears are always watching and always listening. And children are not just the church of tomorrow, they are part of the church of today. And I often tell churches when I work with them that if you want to have some sense of the health of your congregation, listen to your children. Listen to what they say about your community. Listen to how they respond to what happens here. And if we embrace children in the life of a community that is endeavoring to be ever maturing as the people of God, then again, what is the role of leadership in all of that? But then what becomes the power of worship in relation to that? And especially for children, as they engage in worship, that truly is not just some entertainment that's going on for the sake of the masses, then what are children capturing from worship that is part of a community's expression that is seeking before God to be the people of God? Then, he said, teaching makes sense. Teaching then helps us to consolidate the experiences that we are having. Teaching gives substance, gives meaning, gives foundation, gives reason, gives rationale, gives a conceptual frame of reference for the experiences that we are having as the people of God. Teaching informs. Teaching shapes a conversation. Teaching enervates the hermeneutical community. When we turn that around and we put teaching first, it too often becomes the pronouncement of one person to a gathered group, rather than the shared thought and heart of a whole group. So I ask you again, what is the role of leadership in all of this? Thinking about the comments last night, and as we anticipate continuing comments as we move through the morning and through the day, if I turned our typical model of thinking about church upside down, what then, I ask you again, becomes the appropriate definition of leadership? If we begin with the people of God, the community of faith, and we think and believe that there are then certain experiences and functions in which all the people can participate, experiences that facilitate the development of the community of faith, worship, intergenerational learning, service, social events, and so on, that all of the people can be part of, including children, then out of that matrix that is formed as we are together, there will inevitably be the realization that there are certain specialized functions that are needed to address specific needs, concerns, ministry-focused issues. Some of these are age-related, many are time-specific. These down here represent ministries, programs, if you will, short-term, long-term experiences that become part of the particular, peculiar expression of the community of faith that finds its life up here. And I would maintain to you, whatever the language I want here, I would suggest to you that the pattern that we have established for institution building, in the North American church at least, is upside down. We begin here. And these are the marks of a successful church if we do these really well. And we get lots of people coming. And we reach all kinds of people in our community. And we get them all together in these kinds of things. And then somehow we hope, and we have somewhere in the background, oh yeah, we're a people of God. Okay, well, I don't know how to articulate that or manifest it, so let me do this. This is easier. And I would maintain that we've got our model upside down. And if we begin thinking about the imperatives that it is God who gathers his people for his purposes, what becomes the purpose of our assembling and what becomes the purpose of leadership. And then how do we address issues of relevance, meeting needs, contextualization, speaking a voice to and into our culture, interacting with our friends around the world. What does that become if we begin here instead of here? Those of you that I challenged last night or invited last night to be part of a conversation group, if you remember who you are, could you come and take a seat here? And there are others of you that could also be part of this, and I'm aware of that. But these folk that kind of came into my orbit yesterday, and I put them on the spot by dragging them here. Sure. Thanks, Bill. Let's get these microphones freed up here. I have no idea where this is going to go. I think it would be appropriate very quickly just to give a bit of your pedigree, name and what you do.
I'm Laurel McAllister. I've had a missionary career and missionary training. 4 months ago I got married, and I'm not quite sure who I am and what I'm doing now. Big move up to Abbotsford, and I guess that's enough.
Axel Schoburn, I pastor at First Baptist in Penticton, B.C.
Doug Ward, a pastor in Kanata, just outside of Ottawa. I have a suburban work.
Bob Freiling, I've worked with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship for about 30 years, and I'm currently publisher of InterVarsity Press.
Diane Jansen, I'm from Abbotsford Seven Oaks Alliance, and I do women's ministries.
I'm Greg Schroeder. I'm a senior minister at Pacific Community Church, a church plant that happened about 8 years ago.
I'm Peter Quack. I was born and raised in Singapore, but came to Regent many years ago, and been in this position as director of education and initiatives here at the college for the last 6 years.
All right, I don't want to structure our conversation unduly because you each bring your own intelligence and your own passion to what's been happening here this last day and a half. Just to get us going, and any of you, just grab a mic and speak, and if you're too many of you are too silent, I'll stick a mic in your face. Perhaps we could take this road in a couple of directions, if you will, or take it somewhere else. What issue has been addressed here or touched on here that you believe needs to be further articulated, further defined and described as we are trying to make our way forward in new and renewed conceptions of the body of Christ? Okay, that might be one way to go, is for you to name an idea or an issue that you believe has been stimulated here but is not needs to be further described, or talk about what you are learning about your own ministry as someone who is named as a leader in your community. And as you reflect across your pattern of professional work, what has changed in you? What have been important stages on that process of definition for you of what leadership for the people of God really means? If you want to take it someplace else, that's fine, but somebody just get us going.
One of the challenges for me as I'm sitting here is that I'm part of a group that has grown rapidly, and that our lack of structure is hurting us significantly in places. And as a new church, I think we are thoughtful about structures and about some of the implications, because there is no status quo. We can't say, oh, well, it's always been this way, and so that must be a good reflection of God's values in our setting. So we have to think actively about this. And a couple of weeks ago, I met with a group of about 20 pastors of larger churches. And for many of them, these questions of structures are significant. They're not the most important. They're not the goal. And structure doesn't create life, but where you lack it, it can sure hinder it. And so I would really like us to move beyond what at times looks to me like caricatures and say, well, how do we do this process of taking these values and translate them practically into the structures that are going to work? I don't think it can be a paper thing. It may show up on paper, but this idea of institutions has to happen relationally, because it can look great on paper, but if it isn't happening in the relationships, it won't happen at all. So for me, how does my role need to change in our community? Because I don't want it to be a one-man show, never have wanted it to be a one-man show, want it to be values that are passed on beyond generations, but how can I do that? I'd like more answers along that kind of line.
The one that struck me this morning and last night was Dallas's reference to the voluntary syndrome, and it's actually taking what you said, Greg, a little bit further. I agree that when we as leaders take on pressure to keep the people in the church, that it introduces enormous distortions. And so in that sense, I think everything you said about it was bang on. But we've been trying to structure our church life on the assumption that everything is voluntary, and that the biggest and best thing we could do is help people want to love Jesus, want to do ministry, want to reach out to their friends and neighbors. And I think over years that's begun to happen. And the strength in that voluntary principle at that point is beyond my wildest dreams, and I would think is much to be commended over anything that sets expectations but has the risk of becoming law. And so while I agree with what you said, I know from my own experience, I really think that the voluntary principle is at the same time the greatest possible strength in the church, not just its potential greatest weakness.
Maybe the challenge is this, is how do you live in a body where you have obligations, but you don't fulfill those out of a sense of obligation, but with freedom? Where do we discover the freedom to serve?
And I think the that comes, for example, we're often concerned about evangelism training, stewardship training, things like that. In our church, we don't do any of that. We plow entirely into the whole notion of how we can know Jesus and how that shows in our relationships, in our home, with one another, in our decision-making, including at our business meetings. There is moments at which, I haven't had to do it for a long time, but I've done it, where I have had to say to people, this is not the right way to treat one another in the body of Christ. Can we go back over this discussion and do it the right way? And the issue is set aside for the learning of how we treat one another. And our church actually was incredibly fractious about 8 years ago. Now it happens to be known in our small city, which is one of the reasons why it is widely known, as an incredibly harmonious place. It's turned around that rapidly, but that's where it began, is in those kind of things. And I think the evangelism, like, we can't keep newcomers away. They keep inviting their friends, but we never tell them to. They just do it because they want to. The giving is beyond what we need year after year, but we don't tell them to give. They just do it because they want to. So, I don't know. Maybe that's enough said.
Okay. Let Let me interject here before we move to somebody else. And someone else pick up on this thread or introduce another one. Diane, if you're, go ahead if you want to. But let me suggest to the larger gathering here, as you're hearing these comments, not only think about what is being said, but think about what's underneath what is being said in terms of the implicit role of leadership that is being reflected here. Axel's last statement, I needed to step in and remind them that. Okay? So what? Think about not only what the issue is, but also what the issue is inferring about the role of leadership or the definition or the meaning of leadership in the church as it is being formed. Okay, someone else, take us down this road a little further. Anybody?
Go ahead. Well, I guess just speaking from experience, I was involved in women's ministries for a lot of years, and then not involved in a local church about 6 years ago for a couple years, and it's like God just kept everybody away from me, and friends dropped away, and the church went through a hard time, and I was put on the sidelines, and it was a time of deep growth for me. In loving God and letting God love me. And through those about 2 years of not doing anything, I never felt more loved and more accepted, and I wanted to stay there forever. And God grew me in different ways. It's not about position, it's not about power, it's not about title, it's not about pay, it's not about any of those things. And it's about what you asked me to do. And so I knew at the end of that, I was having long teeth and saying, I don't want to go back into ministry. I don't want to go back into the local church. I just want to stay where I am. But I knew he was drawing me back and back into women's ministries. So I said, God, I cannot do it the way I did it before. And he says, great, I don't want you to. And so when I went in, I did something fairly radical and dumped all the programs and started at ground zero. And except for the missions group, which is pretty much a sacred cow, and you didn't touch that. So that was fine. They were doing fine anyway, and they were doing a great job. So we started out with nothing, and I said, I will continue to do nothing until God tells me what to do, or God tells us what to do. And it didn't matter to me if people said, why did they put her in that position? She's not doing nothing. And like, it didn't matter anymore, because it was about God, and it wasn't about me and what I could do or not do. And so our little slogan was, as I pulled a wide range of women together, from seniors to 20s to single moms, and said, what do you think God is telling us? And we listened to God, and we trusted him, and we would do the next thing he would tell us to do, and then the next thing he would tell us to do. And the key is listening to God. It sounds so simple. And it's sort of like, don't we always do that? But no, I didn't always do that. And the key is, what is God calling you to do in your local church? And at this point, when we had nobody, God has grown it. And he is healing people. I am seeing gifts in women that I've never seen before. Didn't even know that they existed. In the gift of inspired scripture for a single mom who hasn't walked with God very long, but he so clearly shows her scriptures, look at this, look at this, look at this, and brings healing into her life. And she has become the wounded healer to walk alongside others. Our evening groups were all led by divorced women. And that was okay, because they were the wounded healers who needed to walk beside others. And I freed them to do that. And there was such a freedom, not a comparison or a competition. But God is, I see him using the little and the least among us. Not the ones who were always at the front before. And it's quite interesting.
that enough?
I'd like to follow up on what you're saying. This last couple of days is like drinking from a fire hose. I don't know how the rest of you are feeling. After Linda deconstructed the church yesterday, I did what most of us are probably doing. You certainly must have one model you're going to leave us with. I know you're not going to do that. I come from a practitioner's point of view. I want the model. So I'm not going to get it. I know that. That's fine. I feel better. Diane? I pastor a suburban work, classic suburbia. We have 300 high-tech companies in our little village of, it's called Ottawa, and they're right in my backyard, and that's my community, and that's who I'm dealing with. So I'm in a dot-com world. We're going to call it KBC.com when I get back. I think that's the way we should go. It is a scary environment to be in because people that walk into my building and into my life every day and into our ministry are carrying the enormous load of 80-hour work weeks and completely technocrated. They are techno geeks at the highest level. They're writing the stuff that you're using. That has created an environment which really frightens me, but is the biggest challenge I can think of. And your point, Diane, was the one that struck me the most. Last night, trying to find a model in my own brain, I think I know what the model is at Kanata that has worked. And it's underneath all the programming and all the other stuff we do, which I think we do fairly well, but that's down the road. There's a conspiracy of suffering in my town of people who are hurting at the highest levels, and they have no place to play that out. They have no community to live that suffering out, and I know that. There's a ministry of brokenness that I think that we have discovered in my congregation that has given the vehicle to allow people to enter our community or the orbit of our community. And it's that we're harnessing brokenness. I mean, there's a great marketing strategy. We have harnessed brokenness. And I think we've done it intentionally and subliminally. I'm not sure we program that. We certainly don't want to. I don't want to do 12-step programs and everything. But something has come out of that. Last summer, 5 boys died in a car accident right outside of my town. Because some of us have a ministry in the high school, we did those funerals for the community because those families had nowhere to go to do the funerals. That was the worst day of my life, doing those funerals. It was a difficult experience. My church has continued to have a ministry in that area with those people. And they've targeted that, and they've really done well with it. And it brought out another thing, that most of the people that walk into our building come with a story, and the story is they have just been divorced, they have just moved to the city, they're just making a change, they're going through a period of suffering, transition. The first thing out of their mouths is this block of life cycle stuff that they're going through. It's the hatch, match, and dispatch thing. And it's not that we're using it as a strategy, it just, that's people's entry level into the life of the community, and it's pouring into us. And one lady has started a ministry, the Ministry of Muffins, in our community, where she, someone on the street that she knows, this young gentleman up here last night that had that block party, she's doing it one-on-one with muffins. And that's the entry level into our community, and I think that's probably the key thing that hit me like a brick last night. Is I'm not going to program that when I get back, but we've got to really look hard at that. If that is what's happening, what God is doing in classic suburbia where everyone looks wonderful, if that's what's really happening, those people in that city have nowhere to play that out. You know, no structures in which their families are all somewhere else. And we, under God, are probably those people. And I don't think I understand what that means yet. But that was really helpful last night. And that really twigged it, Diane. Thank you.
You know, I wonder if the part of the challenge here is we're telling stories where we're nodding and, you know, our hearts are warmed, but they're all hindsight stories. I mean, that's the way stories are. You look back and it makes sense and it looks good and you say, oh yeah, I can affirm that. That was the right thing to do. It's like Kierkegaard said, though, the problem with life is that it's only understood in hindsight but must be lived with foresight. And so while we can affirm these things that have happened already, like in Axel's church, I'm thinking that's great.
But you're making an assumption. I did it on purpose in advance.
Okay.
I knew what I was doing.
Tell us more about that. How did you do that purposefully?
Well, because the church was so highly fractured, I knew we had to do something deliberate to move away from that, because obviously that was... Our church was known as a place where people came to be saved and then have fled to other churches if the story turned out well. Otherwise, they just gave up on the faith, and you got to ask the question about whether they were saved or not. There was just so much fighting going on, and there were at least three factions. I'm not sure that that wasn't optimistic at the time. And I had to set a deliberate course as to what we should do in response to this fractiousness. And I thought, well, the only way we can come together is to listen to one another. And I found it interesting yesterday reading Bonhoeffer's Life Together, and he has a fascinating line in there that says, if we don't listen to one another, if we stop listening to one another, we stop listening to God. Well, there's food for thought. And I said, we have to learn how to listen to one another. And the whole idea of respect is not a word that's found much in Scripture, but it seems to me if we can treat one another with respect, like not say it, not occasionally, but actually do it, then we're starting down the road of Christian community, where there's consistent respect even when we disagree. Well, I had no trouble finding issues on which we disagreed, but so I set my task to be, how do we learn how to function with respect when we disagree? And I started that with staff, which was fairly easy, the deacons board, which took a little bit longer, and then the next place was in our business meetings. And I just simply came into situation after situation. Can I tell you a story of the way it worked out? Our church had a prayer warrior officially voted on and installed in the position. He was the church's prayer warrior. I did the same thing when I heard that, but it wasn't funny. And he would tell everybody how he was up at 4 a.m. in the morning praying for you. And I appreciated his prayers, actually. But there was something wrong with the fact that everybody who came into his orbit knew within the first 30 seconds that he was this wonderful prayer warrior, and I knew that was a problem. Well, we had to go through, as many Baptist churches are going through, the question of what do we do with people who are baptized as believers by another mode somewhere else? Another mode than immersion. And we eventually came to the place where that would not prevent membership, but that was a shift. And that took a number of meetings on our part of respectful listening, and many people entered into that, and it went very well. And of course, we had the added sensitivity of a handful of key people who were leading ministries but couldn't join because they didn't want to be immersed, but and felt their baptism as a believer somewhere else counted. We were about into our third meeting of this, and there was incredible sensitivity and wisdom being shown as the discussion was going back and forth. And then this man, who'd been silent for a good half an hour listening to others, got up and started by saying, I think everything that's been said up to this point is political. And I rushed to the nearest mic, and I said his name, and then said, if that's what you think, you haven't been listening. And that was part of a deliberate strategy on my part to make sure we treat one another with respect. I didn't have to say anything more. There were several consequences. The first one is that he and his wife left the church. They were never back in our church again. And he was royally offended at me for that one statement. About a week later, a key lay leader, when I expressed regret because I sensed their leaving coming, said, oh, don't worry about it. He's been spiritually blackmailing people for years. It's good that he's gone. And I found out over the next few weeks that almost everybody had the same opinion. And so that statement that I'd confronted was a symptom of a much larger problem. And people were glad that it was no longer a weight upon them. The last thing, the sequel, was 2 years later. I was sitting on a board, had nothing to do with my local church. It had people from all across the West at it. I sat down for a meal and did not know, because she was married and therefore last names didn't give it away, that I sat down across the table from this man's daughter. And as soon as I found that out, I lost my appetite. But the story of what she told me was that man, her father, has been doing this to everybody since he was born. You're the first man in his life to stand up to him. He needed it. I mean, I couldn't believe. I was prepared to endure something at that point. But even his daughter said, well done. But it was a deliberate strategy. You have to look for those times where we're not treating one another respectfully, and you point the community, including the offender, back to Christ. And you do that where it's needed, and you take the risks, and the risks are real. But it was not a hindsight.
Maybe if I can go in a little different direction. In the history of the early church, Tertullian asked the great question, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? And this debate of the influence of the academy or secular learning with the life of the church. I think we've added to that the debate, well, what does Wall Street have to do with the church? Or what does Silicon Valley or dot-com world have to do with the church? I'm not sure we're really, and maybe this is part of the point of the conference, to engage in these kinds of issues. I think the principle in the Lord's Prayer in John 17 is tremendously significant, that we are in the world but not of the world. And to pursue those kinds of things when we look at issues of structure, how do we maintain the separateness, the holiness of God's people, and yet the relevance and the contextual realities of the situation he's given to us. And I find a lot of antipathy between the academic world and the business world as it relates to church life, because so much of the educational framework, and I think you're going to get into this afternoon in terms of theological education, comes from a non-business perspective, and yet so many of the parishioners come from the world of commerce. And so you have this clash of what is significant and what is important between this academic world and the world of commerce. And in the pastor has to try to figure out where do these structures work that are relevant to the parishioners and yet seem to be consistent with the person's training. So that would be one area I think is worth pursuing in some kinds of consultations. Another area would be, and it's related to it, is the importance of culture and how culture provides opportunities for the advance of the gospel. I think of Michael Green's book, Evangelism in the Early Church, where he speaks of the Roman road system and the Pax Romana as being the secular vehicles that carried the gospel. Now, we could not look at those things and say that the Roman system was godly or pure or right, but yet God used those vehicles. And what are those vehicles today? What are the communication systems by which people hear the gospel? And I think a number of people are trying to answer those questions, both structurally and in the areas of communication, and that would be very valid for discourse as well. And then the last thing I would add, I think the issue of structures are that they are necessary but not sufficient. And I think you're saying, how do you get to this necessary thing? You don't need structures if you have a very small church, but if God is blessing, then you need to deal with things at a larger level. And somehow structures need to be energized by the Spirit of God. in the world of commerce, sometimes people look at product-driven companies versus market-driven companies. So McDonald's is a product-driven company. They just take its product and push it everywhere in the world. And we have done that sometimes in our missionary enterprise of just transplanting a certain North American model and what Linda said yesterday about that. A market-driven is not necessarily the best alternative because then, but it has perspectives that can be helpful on that. What we really need is a spirit-driven church that takes the gospel and is in the wonder of it, but is not limited to the structures of modernity, the structures of our theological systems that have been limited to Western culture, but are maybe more relevant to postmodern culture and also to ethnic cultures and minorities throughout the world. So I think that's a whole big issue as well.
I'm wondering if perhaps my own struggle with leadership and the church has come to the point where I feel greatly disillusioned by what I see in my church experiences currently. I mean, I have been a pastor in Singapore and been a pastor here in Vancouver and now working in a theological institution. My sense of leadership in the context of a theological institution, I think, is quite different from what I think would operate or would be called for in the context of a local church. Here at the college, you have departments and you have a variety of structures that are already put in place or inherited over the years. In the context of a church where I find myself as a pastor, I used to think that I needed to manage the church. That is to say that I felt very strongly the need to try to sort through the various resources that we have at hand and try to think of ways to mobilize the membership, try to think of ways to engage them in ministry. And of course, given my own interest in preaching and teaching, that was a priority ministry for myself. But the more I think about how I used to be engaged in church ministry, the more I realized that actually I was very unprepared for it, firstly, but secondly, that I was very much thinking about how to make the church work, try to fix the problems and try to find solutions to the issues. And I realized that maybe my whole perspective was just very much like the world's, no different from a corporation, no different from an organization or an association or a club or whatever. And so, you know, made me thinking, Axel, about the issues that you're facing in your church about things like respect and how to ensure that they become operationalized values within the context of that community. But then I could ask, and forgive me if I ask this question, I could ask the question, isn't respect also found in any club or any association or any other group which may not be Christian? And there's a sense in which they too have to work through those issues as well. So what makes that issue or that value distinctively Christian in your community as compared to any others? And no, that's not a question for you to, for me to, you know, to raise here, but that's just the point that I'm trying to make for myself is that what are the things that I've been struggling with in a local church were distinctively or uniquely shaped by my understanding of the gospel and by my understanding of the people of God. And I realized that I wasn't thinking along those lines. And so now, in my own thinking about leadership in the context of the local church as an expression of what it means to be the people of God, that I have to ask myself, what images and models do I have to give up so that I can once again embrace, hopefully, a more gospel-directed and more Christ-centered understanding of ministry and leadership? And then at the same time, I realize that there are certain images that are given in Scripture that are quite persistent and that I found very helpful. For example, the image of the shepherd. And that is attributed in Scripture not only to God, but also to the Lord Jesus Christ, but also given in the form of, as it were, a transference to his disciples, where Jesus basically affirmed Peter in that role of feeding my sheep, feeding the sheep, feeding the lambs. And it seems to me that maybe there are images of leadership that are quite enduring in Scripture that continue to be quite countercultural as well in the times in which we live in. I mean, I'm an urbanite. I do not know how to look after sheep in the true sense of farming. But at the same time, I find that thinking about sheep and thinking about being a shepherd very, very refreshing. For example, when I learned how to understand Psalm 23, or when I learned what Jesus was trying to say about himself as a good shepherd, I also learned what it means to be the sheep. And in learning what it means to be the sheep, we also learn what it means to then take on that important responsibility of being the shepherd. Examples of which would be, therefore, thinking of what Paul himself said, be followers of me even as I am a follower of Jesus Christ. He didn't say, you are my followers because I am the appointed leader. But he said, the followership and my example of being a follower is far more important to you as a follower than it is of drawing attention to my leadership, in quotation marks. And that's why I feel that there's a sense in which there is a kind of a paradox here, that the title of this conference is The Unnecessary Leader. That we need to pay attention more about what it means to be the follower of Jesus in the times in which we live in, because we are the people of God. And it moves then, immediately, moves us away from the issues of volunteerism. Because it's not a question of whether or not it's a choice of wanting to belong to this community or wanting to do this or that task. It's going to emerge out of and arise naturally out of what it means to follow Jesus in the times in which we live in. And if part of following Jesus and obedience and discipleship involves giving of my time, of my money, and engaging in certain sets of relationships and ministries, then that's what we should be recognizing in the context of the local church. Then it's no longer a question of calling for volunteers, but rather helping people to listen to the call of God.
Yes, that's right.
You know, and then we are being freed then from the need to, as it were, lay down the what you need to do in specifics, but rather what we are called upon as shepherds is to say, this is the boundary within which you're freely to graze, as it were. And we need to provide those boundaries as leaders because of the fact that we are living in a world which is truly hostile to the gospel, and therefore we need to be aware of those areas of confrontation. I think enough said.
As far as that respect thing is concerned, that was just the starting point. Consciously, what goes further than that is that whole scriptural teaching on what's flesh dynamics and spirit dynamics, learning to suppress the one and encourage the other. And I agree with you that as far as leadership is concerned, the biggest thing I can give to my congregation is learn how to suppress the flesh dynamics and encourage the spirit dynamics in my own life so that I can assist them in their walk, but also model it without words.
It's curious to me that in every positive application of values that we've described here, they came out of some sense of failure or mess or crisis. And so it wasn't so much that we sat down beforehand and said, okay, I've got this idea of a perfect world and I'm going to make it happen. We started out with the messy world we live in. And I think if even in your teaching to us, you could help us make that transition from mess to what's right, instead of starting with a blank sheet of paper, That's where we live.
Maybe I can follow up on that one with some of the messes that I see, and basically three chasms where within our churches there are people very, very fall apart. And just a bit about my church background, I came from Colorado Springs, where I was part of a church plant there. It's 15 years old now, but they started from scratch, and I got in on some wonderful things that have been happening there. Moved to this area with an older church, not that much older, but a chasm between the old saints and the youth and the younger ones and so on. And what I'm seeing now is, how do we help those people to listen to each other, to do the kinds of things that you're doing? Because all I'm hearing now from certain, you know, little bits, I'm a newcomer, so I'm just trying to listen. Don't like the music, don't like this, don't like this, don't like this. And then the other ones who are trying very much to minister, I think with a godly attitude, and reach the people. And some of the young people are saying, this is great. And they are drawn. So it's that gap, I think, between the older saints and I'm an older saint in some ways myself. I mean, not, I mean older, not but the saint part. then another aspect is the whole gender area. And I, again, came out of a church where I could be an elder and was affirmed for that. And in many places, that's not possible for women. And I don't want to get into that at all. But how are we using, not using in a bad sense, but how are we enabling women and men to work together in godly ways so that gifts are used? And that those 2 years as an elder in that church in Colorado Springs were some of the best years of my life as far as working within a church, and got in on certain things that I would never have been involved in before. I'm internally grateful for that experience, but I would like it for other people, and at least the outcomes and the ways of, again, respect, of affirmation of people's gifts and abilities that happen. Maybe there are other ways to do it that happened to be okay in that church I was in. And then the whole mission part of things. Once again, I think it's some gap between the old traditional kinds of missions, and I've been a part of that, and then the new ones that are coming along, the short-term kinds of things, the various things that are pulling people in and making them excited. But how do we use all of that, and how do we... Anyway, those are some of the gap kinds of things that I'm seeing that we need to talk with each other about. We need to listen, and we need to pull together. And also, oh, one last thing. I see Linda standing.
Go ahead.
That may
go ahead.
Be my cue.
No, go ahead.
And this is the whole idea of transitions that you talked about, Doug, and how transitions in our lives bring us close to God and help us to sit back. And these last few months for me have been sitting thinking, who am I? What am I doing? And how am I listening to God? And it hasn't been easy, I'll tell you that, coming from a full-time, very busy life to a less busy life, and yet lots to learn. So building on the whole transition experience, I think maybe a valid one for us, because transition is more life now than it used to be. And people are in it all the time.
Right. Okay. We are getting near time here for this session. What I would like to try and do in the remaining moments is focus on a few things that I heard. Then when we come back this afternoon, we will hear Dallas and his insights for us next. And when we come back this afternoon, to create a slightly different kind of a mode of interaction, where there's more opportunity for you to respond as this size of group allows. Let me highlight a few things that I heard, especially related to this concern about structure and this tension that we feel between understanding the messiness and the jello-like quality of much that's being said here, but also needing to go away with something concrete. You know, what am I going to do next? And Doug's words are right. That's not going to come from either one of us. But certainly it's something that needs to be part of our thinking. Some thoughts, and as you think your thoughts, we will try and bring these together this afternoon. The word structure emerged several times in conversation here today. Structure that allows for the tension between hearing what God's imperatives are for us and making, creating systems or creating ways of meeting and patterns of relating that put us in the mode of listening for God's voice. And then other structures that allow for that voluntary choice of responding to God that Axel was speaking about. So two different kinds of structure are needed there. You know, structures for listening and structures for acting and enabling persons who are acting. As Diane was speaking, I remembered another professor friend who said, "Beware of those who have heard from God since you have." And there's a danger inherent in thinking of leaders as voicing God's thoughts or God's mind for the people. So beware of those who've heard from God since you have. And the gentle example coming from Diane and others in this group is the invitation to the gathered people both to seek to discern God's mind and to voice it. And even when there is difference of perspective and difference of opinion, that difference is allowed as we continue to grow in our ability to understand God's voice. Sometime, look at Acts chapter 20 and Acts chapter 21. In Acts chapter 20, and there are different versions you'll need to look at for this, the NIV is the most glaring in this matter. But in Acts chapter 20, Paul says, "I am compelled by the Spirit to go to Jerusalem." When he comes among the people from Ephesus, the people from Ephesus, reinforced by a prophet, if you please, say, "The Spirit is telling us that you are not to go to Jerusalem." Now try to put that together in terms of the implications of that for leadership and structure. There was mention made of Doug with the conspiracy of suffering and the need for places to live out that suffering. Can we think about structures as ways to allow people entry into those experiences and values that truly give meaning to life and truly give meaning to suffering? In other words, to repeat, to remember something Dallas mentioned yesterday, the formation of places where life can be lived in its entirety, in its fullness, and where Jesus' message can be heard. In the latter part of this conversation, we had comments that were stimulating ideas about structures, that structures are formed as we reflect upon not only our past, but also the long past of the Christian church. And if we pay attention to the past, that is instructive for what we do with structures in the present. But also, structures are formed, as you heard others speaking, structures are formed around what we discern God is doing among us and what God is doing in culture. And we form structures to enable the church to act and react to what we perceive God is doing. We heard another rationale for the formation of structures, and that is to address what are discerned as inconsistencies or immaturities or inappropriateness in the way people are responding, in the way people are living in relation to what God requires of his people. And the need for someone in that assembly to name or to give voice to the inappropriateness of this behavior or this thought. In other words, the prophetic, not pathetic, the prophetic role of the person in the community who says, has not God said, or God has not said. So what kind of structures will allow those kinds of voices to be heard? Another rationale for structure that relates to that is forming structures that allow issues and problems and so on to actually be named, you know, to name them so that they can be talked about. And this can only be done in the gathering of God's people. So the naming in board meetings and then sending out papers for people to read is not probably the best way, but to form ways of gathering where matters can be named and then dealt with appropriately in the gathering of people. It struck me as these men and women were talking that the richness of the roles that they were portraying, people entering into situations, entering into them with courage to take a stand, people who are mirroring back to a people what they see in order to open up dialogue around what is mirrored, people who are pointing to any number of possible directions for the people of God. Finally, as they talked, the need for structures, or the way to look at structures that will allow the people of God as a people to be in the world but not of it. So how do you do that? We are in the world in that we become a viable presence to people who are, in fact, asking us, why do you believe in God? Or why do you still believe in God? And we are in the world embodying that, but we are not of the world, because so often the message that we have creates conflict and dissonance among those who see us and hear us. There is much more that is said. The last remark struck me as interesting, Laurel's remark about transitions. And it struck me that something James Loder at Princeton said one time, he was taking exception to theories of developmentalism and interpreting human development only in terms of moving from this stage to this stage to this stage to this stage. And he said, we need another way to look at developmentalism, and I think he's right, but the way of looking at developmentalism that looks at the transition rather than the stage that you are in. Seek the transition and look at the transition. And the point he was making, that the Spirit of God is active in the transition. And so it's not so much the stage we are in, it's what has brought us to that point and what we are moving into by way of transition as we move to the next point. And in this regard, Peter's comment is instructive, that the role of the leader is embodied, or is shaped, I guess more appropriately, is shaped by the leader's experiences with God in a very real way. And the importance of then being persons who are engaged in growing spiritually and ministering spiritually with a people rather than on behalf of a people, so that our lives have synergy together. There's much more here that needs to be unpacked. And as we go on break now and then come back to hear our brother speak to us about matters that are on his heart, then we'll move into another mode of conversation this afternoon.